But it really is in keeping with the teachings on the Buddha's way to happiness. As I mentioned earlier this morning, the Buddha was called the Happy One. And so everything about the teachings is designed to both, in a relative sense, cultivate in our lives that which causes us to feel happy. But it's mostly aimed at creating those inner conditions of well-being and happiness that lead to the highest happiness, which is the heart that is free, the heart that can express the most noble of human qualities in the most effortless way, where each of us becomes an embodiment of Buddhahood, the kind of a happiness of a mind that just easily moves toward affection. And when that affection meets pain, it easily expresses itself as compassion. It easily expresses itself as altruistic joy when it meets others or situations that are happy situation. And it more easily expresses itself as this kind of vast, impartial, open heart that can meet the joys and sorrows with understanding and balance and ease. So it all moves toward this, the highest happiness, which is peace. We'll talk more about that this afternoon. But the ground at which that is made possible, the Buddha was very clear. The first thing that he talked about with lay people like us, before he ever gave any teachings on meditation, on meditative insight, before he gave teachings on anything, he gave teachings on dana. Because dana, as he described, could reliably become in our lives every way that we practice it. And I love that the different ways that dana were already practiced here. And you're literally sitting in a field of dana. All that's gone into creating the conditions for us to practice, that's been the generosity of heart. No one did that for, there was not a fee for service in that regard. And so the Buddha was very clear that in whatever way you can in your life practice generosity, it will, and almost anybody here, if we did a little survey, you would verify that there is joy when you think about being generous. When you think about buying something for a near and dear one or giving, there's joy in the thought of it, there's joy in the act of it, and joy in the memory of it. And you keep practicing that kind of joy, you become more joyful. Of course, that's the joy of having a good mood. It's the joy of gladness. And gladness is the ground. Before we do any kind of stabilizing of our attention, we gladden it. We get comfortable in our bodies. We agree to be together and non-harming. We gladden our hearts by experiencing the pleasure of non-harming. We smooth our bodies. So gladdening is the ground, and generosity is one of those things that gladdens our hearts and brings. And at the same time, it is it's an expression of that highest happiness, that sense of freedom, that sense of non-clinging, non-self, non-separateness. There's just such a sense of letting go of our individualism, our isolation in every act of being generous. So most of you probably have heard all these teachings on generosity, but the one that I found very moving when I first heard it is the Buddha saying that if we knew what a liberating force it was to practice generosity, we would not let a single meal pass without sharing it. And I've taken that to heart, not necessarily in sharing meals, but in being generous. And clearly, I'm here because people have been generous to me. And in order for me to move on to the next group, it will depend on your generosity. So that's the wheel of of that's the river of generosity that the teachings have flowed on all these years. And so not so when you offer, Donna, you don't just offer to supporting VIMS and supporting me. You offer it to the next group that can meet with you and the next group that can meet with me. And it really, it goes like that, heart to heart, mind to mind, joy to joy. And it gladdens our hearts. I was the beneficiary of, you know, of course, I've been a yogi. I spent more than 3 years of my life in silence doing intensive practice, different periods. And one of my practice periods was in what today is called, I always get it wrong, Myanmar. But when I was there, it was Burma. And when I went to Burma, I went to a monastery that was one of the largest monasteries in Rangoon, which is now Yangon or what. And this monastery was a field of dana, of generosity. And of course, it's built into the culture there that people give to cultivate merit, you know, meritorious action. It's considered a cause of well-being, but also a cause of a future life that is happier. But for what, even if there is mixed motivation, the result is that people just are constantly giving. This particular monastery had 84 buildings, that, and all offered by Donna. And when I went there, there was never any mention of Donna. To me or to any of the other Westerners who were there, or any of the other yogis who were there. It was so implicit in the culture that I was just there. No, there was no charge for me to be there. All my meals were offered to me. In fact, the meals came in two processions every day into this large hall, and there were tables set up. And most days of the year, the 3 months I was there, most days there was a feast, and there were two processions of people coming in, and all the nuns, all the monks, all the lay people, and then after the very young monks would come the Westerners. We were at the bottom of the barrel, so to speak, and it was the cutest thing to watch the little novice monks that were about this high, dragging their robes behind them. And but the most amazing thing was going into this dining hall, knowing what a impoverished country this is. And each time that there was a meal, which is, I would say, 80% of the days that I was there, each time there was a meal offered by a family to the entirety. And I found out later that they would often give half of their annual income to be able to feed the nuns and the monks for that day. And the family that offered that meal, their name would be posted on a bulletin board, and they would be sitting behind a cordoned off area and looking out at everyone taking in this feast, and they would be beaming with the joy of having offered that meal. So even if they had all kinds of unwholesome motivation, it brought so much joy. And I always remember sitting across from, I went with a friend to Burma this particular trip, and we wouldn't talk to each other, but we would see each other at meals, and the Westerners were all sitting together. So we would look over at this group, we would then look at each other, look over at the group, and then we would both just start weeping because we're just so moved by their generosity. And this is a culture that has this gift economy just built into it. And it's just, we have to somehow relearn this because we've gotten so enmeshed in this kind of fee for service. What's something worth? What's the contemplation? How many people are here? How much, if I divide it by this and this and that. Instead, it's really meant to be this feeling of offering a gift from the heart and that has to meet that standard of feeling generous enough that you have some gladness when you think about it, act on it, and remember it, so that it's not a feeling where it's too much that you regret it, too little that you don't feel it. And that's a contemplation, and it's a little awkward at first if you're not used to this whole thing. But I know this is a pretty experienced group, so I hope you are finding joy in that in that either in volunteering or offering Donna for VIMS or offering Donna to teachers. I know for me at first I didn't really know how to deal with it, but slowly, slowly I felt like it became quite clear, and there's now real joy in offering, and may we all experience the joy of generosity. And it's part of the happiness of the Buddha. So thanks for listening to that. And thank you for your beautiful, succinct Dana talk. Now, as we try to do with everything of our life while we're on this retreat, except the stuff that comes unbidden, it's now time to forget everything that was just said and realize that whatever has passed, whatever is of the past has passed. It's like, you know, it doesn't exist now except as a memory. I like to really consider that. And the future doesn't exist except as an idea, as a worry or a plan or excitement. But we have an opportunity here to forget the past and to forget the future for the purpose of gladdening the heart, mind, body, regulating our nervous system. We forget the past and the future, and we even forget ideas of the present. We step out of all the three times and we just connect with life. Right where it connects with us. Through this, what the Buddha called this fathom-long body, with its senses and perceptions. And this is a good time to check your back body. We tend to be so forward-leaning that we tend to topple forward, lean. So being aware of our back body, and you'll notice if you're aware of your back body that there's no past back there. It's just sensation. It's just a feeling of space. And then sensing the front body, there's no future there either in front of us. It's just the space. And in real time, what we call present, there's just sensation. History is, at least in this moment, is not what we're aiming for. We're aiming for reality, which makes the present so vital, real-time vital. Feel that those living sensations that come from being embodied. If the whole body feels too much, just sense the arms and the legs. And the other touch sensations, points of sensation that feel like they give the sense of a whole body. And then the fact that we are aware, without awareness, we don't know the body. With awareness, we know the sensations of sitting. So we bring these two together, awareness and body. It's the presence of awareness. And And we feel a gentle stillness. As well, the little micro movements, the gentle waves at the of sensation that arises our body breathes. And we, as following the instructions of the Venerable Ajahn Chah, don't let your mind leave your body. We stay here as long as it lasts. As before, inevitably our mind will drift into imagination. And if we notice it, it's just the thinking mind. If we don't, we may become lost in thought. But once we wake up again, we appreciate that we're now present, and we put our mind back in our body as a support to remaining in reality. If we stay here long enough, inevitably there will be other sense experience that becomes stronger than the general experience of sitting or hands or breath. And you'll notice that every sensation that calls our attention and lights up becomes stronger than the general sensation of sitting. Breathing. Whatever sensation lights up will come accompanied with a valence or a feeling tone. It will either be pleasant, and we can sense that pleasantness. It'll be unpleasant. We can sense the unpleasantness. Or it will be neither pleasant or unpleasant. It'll be just an obvious sensation that has a quality of neutrality. We attempt to sense this because it's often our reaction to pleasant, unpleasant, or neither pleasant or unpleasant that sends us on a journey of seeking or spacing out or rejecting. By being somewhat attuned to the pleasantness and the unpleasantness, neutrality, being able to accommodate these feelings, these feeling tones, that we are able to stay here. We cut the chain that usually leads to an imaginary journey in time to that place where we think we will be happier. Instead, we stay here. We find that the cure for whatever we are experiencing is in whatever we're experiencing. And the longer we linger here, the more we learn to accommodate the pleasant and let it wash over us and experience pleasant sensations as changing conditions, and we learn the Dharma. So any sensation can become the ground at which we understand the teachings and the cause of our liberation. If we learn to accommodate the unpleasant, we can realize the Dharma, that it's not so much the unpleasant that is the suffering, it's the reaction to the unpleasant, the dislike and the aversion, fear. And we learn how to have unpleasant sensations without a mental reaction. So we decouple pain and suffering. We may have painful feelings, but our mind has the option of non-suffering in the face of that. So slowly, slowly, we accommodate the pleasant, the unpleasant, the neither pleasant or unpleasant, so that there's no experience that causes us to go out in search of a happiness that never arrives. It gives us the opportunity to realize that all search for this happiness elsewhere just adds to our stress. And the only happiness worth that name is the natural happiness of being awake to what's happening and knowing for ourselves that whatever arises fades away. And then the unpleasant can become the cause of self-compassion or mercy. The pleasant can become the cause of gladdening and insight into the changing nature of pleasant experience. The neutral can, rather than becoming the cause of spacing out and boredom and disinterest, it becomes the cause of even-mindedness and equanimity. So if some sensation comes, we turn toward it. We open to it. We make space for it. The art of meditation is the art of making space. And we can be helped by simply naming or noting aching, aching, burning, burning. If, on the other hand, you find that you are unable to accommodate the painful sensation or the really unpleasant sensation, then at this phase in the retreat, it can be helpful to not try to stay with it too long, to redirect your attention to something that you can accommodate more easily. Back to your primary anchor. Find some sensation in your body that is not so painful. Just to remind yourself that not everything is this painful experience. You may find it necessary to make a change in posture to refresh yourself, and this is fine as long as you don't break the continuity of attention as you make movements. So rather than make reactive movements, we make deliberate ones. As we go along in the retreat, we'll also look at the attitude of mind that we are meeting our painful experiences with. So it's often our attitude that will exacerbate the pain and lead to mental suffering. In the meantime, just settle back into the moment. Find your primary anchor. No need to look for these other experiences, but when they light up, when something becomes predominant, we turn toward it to the extent possible, bringing a non-interfering, non-judgmental, non-reactive awareness to the sensation, the feeling tone, opening to life just as it is, an ever-changing field of conditions. Just this moment. Kind attention. is there awareness right now? What are you aware of? You might even check what's the attitude of mind that's present with what you're aware of. Is it open and relaxed? Is there strain to make something happen, or is there resistance to what's happening? Just know that. Don't do anything about it. It will self-correct. Just know what's in your mind. Just this moment.